Marquita coming up and praying for me just changed my sermon a little bit. Believe it or not, totally unwitting. Because how I was going to greet you, if I may borrow from you, is good morning, loved ones. So at this point, I'm just going to say good morning. Peace be with you. Thank you. We as humans have plans. We like plans, yes?
Yes.
I know I do. So who here has made a plan? Okay. Anybody who doesn't have their hand up, you're lying to me, because at some point you had a plan of some sort. Who here has had that plan just totally go and evaporate? Yeah, that's me too. One of the reasons why we like plans, or we tend to plan, is because we like a certain level of predictability. We see something happening a certain way. Part of that was just evidenced in how I started this sermon. I said, good morning. What did you say? Very good. I said, peace be with you. What did you say? I walked up to Stephanie and to Matt. What did I do? Stuck my hand out. They stuck their hands out and shook my hand. These are things that we take for granted because we do them every day. We greet someone, we open a door for them, whatever, and we expect a certain level of reciprocation, a thank you, a please, shake the hand, whatever it may be. While it's not a, I'm going to walk up and Stephanie's going to shake my hand, it might not happen. She might have her hands full. She might be sick, and she might not want to shake my hand. Adam, if you guys remember, many times when he was sick, he would not shake your hand. And it wasn't that he was trying to be rude. It's just that he was sick. He didn't want to get you sick or the other person sick. So he'd bump fists or he'd bump elbows or whatever it may be. He'd just stay 5 feet away and say, peace be with you. So sometimes our plans, whether they're grand plans or whether they're just everyday occurrences, may or may not happen. But we do have other plans. We do have those grand plans. At least most of us do. It may involve school. It may involve relationships. You guys are in one right now. That may be moving on to marriage, jobs, retirement. These are all things that overlay throughout our lives because they're things that we're involved in. Each of these big plans tend to have a bunch of smaller subplans underneath that. I plan on going to school. I plan on getting a job. I plan on getting married. I plan on retiring. And I plan on leaving this earth. But inside of these things, they're just huge compartments of our lives that they're so big that we have to break down even more. So, relationship. If she says yes, maybe we can start dating. Oh my gosh, she said yes. Maybe she'll go out a second time with me, or a third, or a fourth. Oh my gosh, we're actually dating now. This is kind of cool. Time depending on who you are, maybe we should start thinking about the next step of this relationship. I'm going to start courting her with the intent of marriage. Okay. So you start discussing things that are bigger and more involved with both of you and what may happen in your lives and what you'd like to do. You start courting. You become engaged. You get married. Kids? No kids? Don't know, but that's a possibility. Those are things you discuss and think about. The golden years. I want to retire with this woman or this man. What will retirement look like for us? What will it be like to be aged with kids out of the house, if you had kids, and it's back to just being the two of you? What's that going to look like? They're all things that we have a tendency to plan for and pursue. I know a lot of people pursue these consistently in their head. It's like, boom, boom, boom. And you've got so many plans going on at the same time. And because you've got so many different compartments of your life that sometimes it seems overwhelming. And yet, because you're making these plans, you're compartmentalizing them and you're setting them in some sort of order. And you're like, okay, I can deal with this. It doesn't become so overwhelming that you just tear apart. The Marine Corps, okay, Brad's not even here and you're still going to get a Marine Corps illusion. The Marine Corps has a motto that I'm sure other people, other branches of service included, utilize, and just people in general. But it's something that I heard from the Marine Corps, and I've used it many, many times in my life. Improvise, adapt, and overcome. Okay? A lot of times, I'm facing something I don't like, some sort of adversity or whatever, and so, okay, I need to improvise. This was unexpected. I need to adapt. What do I need to change? I need to overcome this. Now, the improvised part implies that what I intended to do cannot be done, or that it cannot be done in the prescribed manner in which I intended to do it. So I have to change something due to the fact that I cannot accomplish that goal. I want to go to the back of the room. I want to make a straight line. I can't do that. So I need to improvise. I've just adapted. Now I overcome. Okay? The adaption, or adapting, is realizing that the situation is different than you had initially thought or anticipated it being. Here, I can walk straight to the back of the room. Somebody threw a chair in front of me. Something has changed. Somehow that situation changed in front of me. Now, the overcoming part, while I appreciate this, utilize it, and absolutely agree with it, the statement that you make when you're making overcome is that you're exiting a situation favorably, but it also states that that situation has conflict or some sort of adversity. A lot of people have a tendency to say, I overcame this. And this portion of that statement is something that's very just normal life stuff. Life happens. Regular things happen. For example, I'm going home. I need to get on the freeway. It should take me 10 minutes. You get on the freeway. There's a traffic jam. There's an accident. Something. It's not going to take you 10 minutes. It takes you 30. You get home. I overcame that traffic jam. No, you sat that traffic jam. That's just something that happens. Somebody steps up to physically assault you, and you get out of that situation. You have overcome a type of adversity. Okay? That is something real that is very effectual to you. So be aware when you say overcome, whether or not you're really thinking about something that is just normal everyday life type stuff, or whether it truly is some sort of adversity. Now, many of you guys know that I love sports. I think every single time I've been up here, I've used a sports analogy. Today is going to be no different. Today is the final day of the greatest bike race known to man. Tour de France. Anybody here follow the tour? A couple of you might. There is a rider in the Tour de France that I really like. I've been following him for about 6 years now. Moderately following him because we in America don't get the good news feeds, shall we say, on the other races aside from the Tour de France. This rider's name is Edvald Boasenhagen. The reason I like Edvald Boasenhagen is because of his name. Honestly, that was how I chose him to follow. They stated his name. I'm like, that's a cool name. He's a Norwegian writer. So he's got a different name, like Edvald and Bösenhagen. Thing is Edvald Bösenhagen is not what we call a general classification writer, a GC writer. He's never going to win the yellow jersey. You guys have heard of the yellow jersey? That's like the person that wins the race wins the yellow jersey. That's a statement of honor, and it's something that they get to, a privilege that they get to carry the rest of their lives. Edvald Bösenhagen, never going to be that guy. Tour de France also has other jerseys. They've got a green jersey, and that's for somebody who's a sprinter. There's different points throughout the race, and each day's race, that somebody who's a sprinter can amass points, and at the end of the race, the person with the most points wins the green jersey. There's a big ceremony at the end awarding that jersey. There's also one for the mountain stages. That's the polka dot jersey. It's actually kind of cool. The person that gets the most mountain points gets the polka dot jersey, and there's the best young rider. That's the rider under 25, and that's a white jersey. Now, there are 22 teams that go into the Tour de France. Each team has 9 riders. You figure most of the teams that are going in are not going to win any of those jerseys. There's 4 jerseys. There's 22 riders. There's 22 teams and 9 riders per team. So 4 out of 200 and change. Very slim odds. So the teams go into this race with different ideas of what they want to do. Some teams go in with the idea of winning the yellow jersey. So everything they do is for that person that they believe can win that jersey, for the yellow jersey. Other teams go in for the green jersey, others for the polka dot jersey, others for the young rider jersey. Some teams are in there just to win a stage, which means one day they win. Now, the idea behind that is they get their team that media coverage, because it's a worldwide event. Everybody in the world who's watching the event sees that team, and they get kudos for that. Now, when you enter the race, you've got all these high hopes, right? You've got a plan, whatever that plan may be. If they're riding for general classification, which right now, the guy who's going to win, or who won, was Chris Froome. His team was there for him to win. Anything else that happened was incidental. Their plan was for Chris Froome to win the yellow jersey. All other 8 riders besides Chris Froome were solely there for him. That was the entire purpose of them being in that race. Whether they were a good rider on the flats, whether they're a fast rider like a sprinter, whether they're good in the mountains, it doesn't matter. Their purpose of being in that race was for Chris Froome. Dimension Data, which is the team that Edvald Bösenhagen is on, they were in it for a sprinter named Mark Cavendish, fastest man in the world on a bicycle. He's won Olympic medals. He's won velodrome medals. He's won all different kinds of sprint medals. He's won multiple stages, like 30 stages, I believe, in the Tour de France, just for sprints. He is a machine. 4th day, he crashed out, broke his shoulder blade. So his entire team that was there for him, they're still in the race. He's out. He's back in Wales, or actually back in the Isle of Man, watching this on TV. So now what is the rest of the team supposed to do? Their plan, their whole purpose for being there, is now gone. So his lead out rider, Mark Renshaw, started working for Edvald Bösenhagen. Edvald stepped into Mark Cavendish's spot and became their sprinter. He's not a sprinter. He's good. He's got great strength and amazing speed, but he's not a sprinter. So they put him out there. His timing is not that of a sprinter's. His mindset is not that of a sprinter's. So 4 different stages throughout the middle of the tour, he came in 3rd, 2nd, 2nd, 3rd. This guy, like I said, is not a sprinter, and he's going up against some of the other best sprinters in the world. One of them, one day, one of his second places, was the closest finish ever in the Tour de France. 3/10,000ths of a second. That's 0.0003. 6 millimeters, about that much, at 45, 48 miles an hour. The other guy threw his bike just across the line enough that the other guy won. Edvald Bosenhagen won Friday. He came through. It was kind of a mountainous-ish stage that turned flat, and he took advantage of his big engine with the people he was riding with. So Edvald got his day in the spotlight, so to speak. Point of this is, all those teams have plans. It turns on a dime. For Dimension Data, it was a split second like that when Mark Cavendish crashed out. Everything that they had planned, the millions and millions of dollars that they put into this for this 3-week race, was gone. Okay, so what are we going to do now? Plans change. They improvised, they adapted, and in this case, overcame in some way, because the adversity of the other 21 teams that were against them. You guys are looking at me going, what does the Tour de France have to do with Jesus? Not a lot. However, if you have your Bibles, please open up to Mark 6. If you got your phones, open that up to Mark 6. I'll give you a second to get there. We're going to be starting in verse 30. The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. He said to them, "Come away to a deserted place all by yourselves and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them as them in the foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. As he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. When it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is now very late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy something for themselves to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves have you? Go and see." When they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass, so that they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. And all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces of the fish. Those who had eaten the loaves numbered 5,000 men. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. After saying farewell to them, he went up to the mountain to pray. So, Jesus and his 12 are cruising with the intent to rest due to the fact that the disciples had just come back from doing what he had sent them out to do. So they're talking about all this stuff. They're tired. Anybody here ever been tired? Exhausted from what they were doing? What do you really, really want to do when you're done doing that thing? Lay down. I want to rest. I don't want anybody to bother me. I want to sit in the back patio and just look at nothing. That middle distance of 60 feet, and you're going, ugh. Jesus and his disciples are going away to a place to be by themselves. They didn't even have time to eat. They're so busy that they didn't even have time to eat. So they're going away to this deserted place. And as he got out on the shore, he had compassion. He saw the crowd. So he asked compassion. They're like sheep without a shepherd. What just happened? Jesus improvised. This is my intent. This is our intent to go do this thing. There's people there. okay, they're like sheep without a shepherd. I'm going to change my plans a little bit. So Jesus improvises, and he begins to teach. The teaching part is also the adaptation. He saw the crowd, he had compassion, improvise, begins to teach, the adaptation. He's adapting to this situation. Get up to verse 36, and the disciples have a plan of their own. They're like, Jesus, send the people away. The hour's late. They need to eat. They're hungry. They've been here all day. You've been talking. They need to eat, so why don't you send them away? Jesus decides to improvise again. So, how much food do you have? How many loaves you got? Let's assess this situation. Disciples go, find out. They give Jesus the information. Jesus is like, okay, we'll adapt to this situation. We got 5 loaves, we got 2 fish. Good enough. Get them to sit down. So the disciples sat them down. Now I will use the overcome part here because food is a staple in life. We kind of have to have food to keep living, food and water. Jesus gives them a basic necessity of staying alive at this point. Although most people can go a day without food, it's not that big of a deal. They're just grumpy and hungry. But the point is the people are there. They not only hear him speak and preach and teach, but they're also receiving at a physical level. It's like Jesus provides for them on a couple different levels there. So Jesus does overcome, in that physical sense, their hunger. He overcomes their necessity for food. The spiritual level, Jesus is fulfilling and doing what is right because the Spirit has moved him, because he had the compassion on the crowd to teach them. This throws off everything that he was planning on doing with the disciples going and resting. So he's been guided by the Spirit because of the compassion he now has for the people that are in front of him. So Jesus is not only improvising, adapting, and overcoming, but Jesus is improvising, adapting, and doing what is right, doing what needs to be done, because the Spirit is saying, do this. Which, oddly enough, because this passage gets taught so often just purely based on the miracle of the loaves and fish, that people bypass the other parts of this specific story. They'll reference back to Jesus when he was tempted by Satan in the 40 days in the desert. And Satan's like, turn the stones into bread. He's like, man does not live by bread alone, but by the word that comes out of the Lord's mouth. He just taught the people. He's teaching the words of the Lord to the people. He is embodying that which he refuted the devil with. But on top of that, he turns around and goes, okay, I'll give him food too. It's like, this is a miracle to everybody else, but this is just meeting your needs on a human physical level. This other stuff that I've been talking about, this is much greater. And we can see it 2,000 years later reading a story, but imagine sitting there and going, I'm hungry. When's this guy going to stop talking? Because I'm hungry. I want to eat. We have trouble doing that for 20 minutes here at church, especially right before lunch. Who knows how long he was teaching? They had walked around an entire lake to go see this guy come out from towns. So Jesus improvises, adapts, does what's right, and overcomes. This passage ends, oddly enough, with the initial plan kind of coming to fruition, because when immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. After saying farewell to them, he went up on the mountain to pray. So Jesus says, okay, guys, go home. You guys can go back to your houses. Disciples, get in the boat, start going to the other side. And he gets to go pray. The disciples are by themselves. Now, granted, they're rowing, so they're not really resting all that much. But chances are, they were fed along with the 5,000 men. I know I'm reading into that maybe a little bit. But I would imagine since they were there with Jesus and they're all sitting down eating, that they also ate. So you go back to the very first part of that passage, where many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. Okay, so they just got fed. So the disciples got fed spiritually and physically. And once Jesus dismissed the crowds and sent the disciples away, they got to be by themselves. So they didn't have a bunch of people pressing in on them. Jesus got to go do his thing by going to the mountain to pray. So oddly enough, the plans that they initially had still came to fruition, just in a far different way than most people would have thought or had looked at and planned for. It's like, okay, you still get to rest. Now, next week's, or the next section, we'll kind of throw that into a little bit of a strange mode, because the disciples don't get to really rest so much, but you guys will catch that next time. Now, we, in our lives, in our regular everyday lives, many times we do have to improvise, adapt, and overcome. We're faced with trials that are truly conflicts. There is truly some sort of adversity. We've got an enemy that seeks to devour us. That is adversity. Sometimes we just get presented with situations that change our plans because life happens. We interact with people. People are people. I can expect Jean to do one thing, and she might do that thing. She might not. She's a human being. She has that free will. She has that choice. So I go in expecting one thing. Good morning. Good morning. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Things happen like that. Weird things change. So sometimes we just adapt to that. Okay. And I continue with my sermon, or continue speaking, or continue talking to you two going, so what's going on with you guys? Are you sick? Just wondering. This is probably the least spiritual thing you will ever hear me say, hopefully, in church. This is a line from Harry Potter, from Goblet of Fire, I believe. It was right at the very end of the movie, also the book. Professor Dumbledore, who's the headmaster of the school, is talking to all the students, including students from other schools who happen to be at this school. And one of the students has just died due to the fact that he was killed by the bad guy in the story. Okay? And Dumbledore states to the students, there's coming a time soon when we're going to be forced to make a choice between that which is easy and that which is right. Yes, this is from the Harry Potter series. Does this still ring true? Yes. There are times when we are going to have to make those decisions between doing what's easy. I plan on sitting down and not preaching. I don't want to sit and talk. I don't want to stand and have that responsibility. So I'm just going to sit here and do my thing right here and just listen. Or am I going to come up here and do what's right because I was asked to do this, because the Lord put this on my heart, because the position is part of it? I'm going to do what's right as opposed to what's easy. Would it have been easy to say no? Not so much, but in essence, it would have been. I mean, I could have said it, but the point is there are times that we will still face doing what's easy or doing what's right. And sometimes what I hope, and this is what I pray also, is that there comes a time when doing what is right is doing what is easy. That it's not even a thought. It just happens so quick that it's like, oh, this is right. Jesus here, stepping ashore, he saw the multitude and had compassion on them because they're like sheep without a shepherd. Boom, decision made. I'm going to preach. We're going to teach. We're going to talk to them because they are lost. I pray that we come to that point as not only as a congregation, but individually. This is also where it ties back to the Tour de France. So you've got a bunch of riders in the race who are doing what they're supposed to be doing, but they're doing it for the team. It's for the team's good. Chris Froome, the guy who won the yellow jersey, his purpose of being there was to win the yellow jersey. Was that for his own accolades? He gets accolades for sure, but that's because he's on that team. Could he have done that without his team? No. What about the other eight riders that rode for him? They're finishing an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours behind him in overall standings. Yet they rode every single day with the purpose of putting him on the podium. That came true. For us, we put in that individual effort for the Lord. He is the one that gets the podium. He's the one that gets the glory. He's the one that gets the honor. And yet, by doing that, we get to go, I worked for that guy. I did this for him. And my job, whatever it may be, on any given day, can change due to the team's request or the team's desire of what they want to do for that day. Same thing with the Spirit. As we're going through, we start interacting with people, and the Spirit goes, you need to talk to that person. You need to go do this. You need to say, you need to express me in some way. And when we do that quickly, it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. Because inside you're going, the Spirit's guiding me, and that is what I'm here for. I'm here to do that for the Lord. So, in your lives, improvise, adapt, do what's right. And by all means, sometimes that will definitely be overcoming. And you get a short message today.